historical trauma is the cumulative emotional and psychological wounding of individuals or of a group or a generation that has been caused by traumatic events or traumatic experiences. Intergenerational trauma is that trauma that gets passed from generation to generation. So when we look at Native communities in particular, you know, you can almost bet that, you know, all of the Native people that are living today are living with that historical trauma and that intergenerational trauma, and that each generation has experienced its own sort of trauma.
And is there something that's happening at a biological level? Because I've heard some scientific studies that it moves beyond just the experience that then is shared, say a parent who's had a certain experience that's imprinted on a child, and then that then goes imprinted. And so we could see how that way you would have intergenerational trauma. But I've also heard about how there actually are changes, physiological and biological changes, as a result of trauma.
Absolutely. There's a lot of research around what they call epigenetic transfer. And so that the change is actually happening, you know, at the gene level, and at the DNA, and that it, you know, will biologically, you know, change somebody's DNA, and that gets passed from generation to generation. There's a lot of studies now that where they actually tested that in mice, and that the transgenerational trauma is actually passed through the male. So there's a lot of really great research out there, studies out there that, you know, that are validating that intergenerational and that transgenerational trauma. And I think that we have to use that that science, you know, to our benefit.
In addition to that, is that compounded then by ongoing oppression experienced by these communities? And I'm thinking of, obviously, Native Americans. We've spoken before, Alicia, about the use of Native American mascots in yes. high schools, and how that has a psychological, it can be very detrimental to young Native Americans. Obviously, what's happening at Standing Rock as well has really put a lot of focus on the ongoing environmental degradation that's experienced by Native Americans around the country. But as I said, the focus is often at Standing Rock. So how did the two things work? Current oppression, current forms of discrimination and current trauma. How does that compound then all of this, you know, the epigenetic stuff and that intergenerational and historical trauma?
That's a big question. but no, it's a valid question. So definitely a lot of the things that we are experiencing today, like Standing Rock, like the mascot issue, you know, it affects us. I think, you know, on a level, it almost triggers that intergenerational and that historical trauma in us, and a lot of us are not even aware that that exists, or maybe we are aware of it, but it's too hard to handle. It's too hard to deal with, and so that in itself often causes, or it is the cause of, so many of the psychosocial issues that we see today, such as the depression and the PTSD and the drugs and alcohol and the abuse that we experience.
And the appalling high rates of suicide,
yes.
particularly amongst young people.
Yep, the high rates of suicides in our communities. And it's just that we have not yet begun to really address those traumas. You know, we always talk about, you know, where do we begin? How do we start to address those issues in our communities? And I really believe that we have to address the root cause of all of that, which is that historical and that intergenerational trauma. And so, you know, and today, you know, so many of our youth are constantly experiencing microaggressions, you know, in the form of mascots, where it's, you know, in our face every day. You know, and looking at what's happening at Standing Rock, there's, you know, so many parallels that you can draw, you know, from the experiences at Standing Rock and the historical experiences that our ancestors have experienced. One of the things that I heard from an elder at Standing Rock said, you know, 150 years ago, they were taking our children from the land, and today they're taking the land from our children. And so to me, that said a lot, you know, that we're not past, you know, all of these, this historical trauma or just the traumas that we experience day to day.
Well, in terms of that elder statement about 150 years ago, they were taking our children from our land. I know that you are a board member of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, and the issue of boarding school and the removal of Native American children from their homes and put into these schools not really being a clear enough term for a lot of the abuse that was experienced. It wasn't education, rather it was a cultural genocide in many ways.
Absolutely.
How does that tie into all of this? The boarding schools, first of all, maybe remind our listeners about the legacy of boarding schools and the impact on Native Americans. And then how does that tie into this historical trauma?
So first of all, I should correct that. I'm no longer on the board. I served my term and stepped off the board. But they're still, National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition is still doing really great work out there and are really focusing on how tribal communities can heal from the boarding school experiences. You know, the boarding schools really started in, you know, the early 1800s. It was a way the United States government was trying to figure out another way to handle this Indian issue. You know, they tried, you know, everything from, you know, flat out annihilation, you know, genocide practices, removal from reservations, removal from tribal lands, onto reservations, I should say. And one of the ways that they, you know, figured out how to assimilate, if they couldn't annihilate, how could they assimilate tribal people? And that was really taking, you know, Native children from their home, from their culture, from their families, and putting them in the boarding schools. And it actually started out, the United States government saw that there was actually a lot of corruption that was happening on the reservations with regards to Indian agents, and the United States government tried to figure out, okay, how do we reduce, you know, some of the issues going on with the Indian agents, and figured that they needed to figure out another way to get these Indian children educated, assimilated, etc. And so they actually turned the responsibility over to the churches rather than the United States government. So they turned that responsibility over to the churches. And I mean, almost every denomination, you know, took part in this, and, you know, several denominations, you know, had certain parts of the country. And schools were opened up around the reservations. So children were going to the schools during the day and coming home at night. And then they started to figure out that wasn't really doing what they wanted to do, which is complete assimilation. So they said, okay, well, that's not working because they're still going home and they're still learning the language. They're speaking the language. They're learning their culture, or continuing to learn from the families and their parents, etc. And so they started building these much larger schools, you know, across the United States, and really forcefully taking children out of the homes and putting them in schools, you know, in all different parts of the U.S. And so by the the turn of the century, it's been estimated that over 100,000 Native children were forcefully removed from their homes and taken to these boarding schools. And so as a result, children didn't grow up, you know, within their families. There was lots of abuse that occurred physically, emotionally, sexually, that occurred within the schools. Children didn't grow up with their language or their customs or their traditions, their spirituality. And many of them, if they came home, brought back a lot of the destructive behaviors that they learned at the school. And many were ashamed of their Indianness, I guess you could say. And again, generationally, these destructive behaviors were passed from generation to generation. And I think when you look at the alcohol and the drug abuse and the sexual abuse in particular, you can almost trace that back to the boarding schools. When I talk to people, I often use my story. I come from four generations of sexual abuse in my family. My great grandfather was 6 years old when he went to the Chinle boarding school, which is in northern Arizona. And he was 6 years old in 1915 and was severely sexually abused and physically abused and ran away. And when he finally came home and had a family, he sexually abused my grandmother and sexually abused my mother and sexually abused me. And so of course we can trace, that back to the boarding schools. It wasn't until, I was in high school, really, that I started to really understand why all of the destructive behaviors in my family, were occurring. And it was sort of like a light bulb went off, when I figured out, that my grandparents, or my mother and my grandparents and my great-grandparents, went to boarding schools, and where all of those behaviors came from, how I learned some of those behaviors as well. And I really had to, address that, and work on my own healing so that trauma ends with me and it doesn't get passed down to my three children, or their children whenever they decide, to have children. There are a lot of us out there with those stories. And unfortunately, there are many more who have not yet recognized that their experiences, recognized that trauma, really understand what has happened to them.
When did the last boarding schools close?
Up until about the 1970s. There are boarding schools still today. They're obviously just not run the way that, the way that they have, the way that they have been. There's still boarding schools, there's boarding schools in Oregon and Oklahoma, California, Arizona. And around the turn of the century, a lot of the boarding schools had been taken out of church hands and put into the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which wasn't, that much better. but they also began to address, a lot of the issues that they were facing in the boarding schools.
We're speaking with Alicia Goodsoldier this morning here at KGNU. She's the co-chair of the Denver American Indian Commission, and she's served in many different capacities here in Colorado. And she's a former board member of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And she's going to be speaking this Friday morning in Boulder at the Naropa campus in North Boulder on 30th. And it's part of the monthly Interface series. And this Friday morning, she'll be talking about understanding historical trauma, how American Indian communities are changing the legacy. So how does healing begin with all of that, particularly, as we said, there's still ongoing oppression and abuse and violence being enacted against Native Americans?
Yeah, I think one of the very first things is to acknowledge the history and to acknowledge the trauma. I always use Governor Hickenlooper's apology for the Sand Creek Massacre as an example of beginning that healing. Cheyenne and Arapaho people, you know, had waited 150 years for somebody to, you know, acknowledge that that atrocity, acknowledge that trauma. I always have this image of in my mind constantly when I look out at the crowd when he was apologizing, and you see elders and youth who were crying, you know, because they had waited, you know, so long for somebody to acknowledge that history. So I always think that that's the first step. And I believe that a return to our culture, our language, our spirituality is also one of those ways that we can begin that healing. You know, we always had, you know, our ceremonies as interventions. That was put in place, you know, for thousands of years, and that's why so many of our, you know, our communities, you know, 200, 300, 400 years ago, and even, you know, up to thousands of years ago, were healthy communities. We worked well with each other. We understood everything around us as, you know, as our relatives, and took care of the land and took care of the animals, and just being in harmony, really. And of course, you know, the United States policies of removal and assimilation and reservations and boarding schools stripped us of a lot of that. And we were lucky, you know, that some of that survived. You know, a lot of our spiritual practices had to go underground in order for it to survive. And it wasn't until, you know, the 1970s when we were able to openly practice our ceremonies again. And so when I, in the presentation, one of the things that I talk about is our youth healing camps that we put on in Pine Ridge, for example, that really help a lot of our youth who are, you know, dealing with serious emotional issues. And it's been amazing to see how a reconnection to the culture and to the language has helped so many of our young people in stopping the destructive behaviors that they engage in, and so it's been a pretty amazing experience for me. And of course, you know, I can't really answer for all, you know, Native people, of course, because, you know, there are 567 very distinct tribal nations with their own language and their languages and their own, spiritual ways and whatnot. And I think that's one of the things that we've struggled within the Boarding School Healing Coalition, is how do we help all these tribes who, you know, have the same sort of traumatic history, when, you know, they all have their own ways of healing and moving through their trauma. But again, I really believe that a reconnection to culture and our traditional ways and the languages is what's going to help us.
And how can non-Native people help in that healing?
I think just being able to, you know, to spread the word, to be allies. I mean, we've obviously, one of the really great examples in the last, you know, year has been Standing Rock, you know, standing up you know, with tribal nations all across the United States and Canada. I mean, I think just Indigenous peoples all over the world standing up for, you know, the right to have clean water, the right to have clean air, the right to openly practice, you know, your own ways, and the right to learn your language. One of the reasons why I do these talks is so that people begin to understand and hope that these events or these traumatic events that got us to this place will never occur again. It'll never happen again. So I think just, you know, people being able to openly sit and sit and listen and hear the experiences and understand why things in our community, you know, exist the way that they do. So I think that's always the first step.
Well, you mentioned Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper's apology for the Sand Creek Massacre. So in terms of at a governmental level, I know Colorado, that apology was made by the governor. And there's also been an effort around removing Native American mascots from high schools. You served also on that commission as well. So maybe at a state level, it sounds like there are certain things happening at a policy level. What about federally, and particularly with Donald Trump's recent appointment to the head of the Indian Affairs that a lot of people are very concerned about? What do you think needs to happen at a state government level, at a federal government level?
I think at the state level, I think we need to continue educating our elected officials, you know, again, about the First Peoples in this area, you know, for example.
I suppose the Indigenous Peoples Day that have recently been celebrated in Boulder and Denver, that's another,
yes,
hopefully positive move forward.
Yes, absolutely. You know, so recognizing the peoples that were here and the people that are still here, you know, in the Denver Metro area, you know, we have, you know, almost 50,000 American Indian people living, you know, living there. So, you know, we have a lot to offer. You know, Colorado's been very fortunate to have a really supportive governor and lieutenant governor, you know, who has worked really well with the Colorado Commission on Indian Affairs. There's, you know, several states out there who do have Commission of Indian Affairs to support tribes in the area or to support the urban Indian community, and have recognized the contributions that, you know, our tribal communities are making to the local area. So I hope that continues, because I think if that is able to continue, then, you know, we'll be able to have a much stronger community. At the national level, I think what Obama has done in the last 8 years has, with regards to Indian people, has been phenomenal, especially in the areas of education and land issues, returning, you know, land issues, voting rights issues. So we've come a long way, and there is definitely a real fear of all of that being undone by the Trump administration. And I believe that tribes are being proactive in really trying to communicate with the incoming administration about what their priorities are and what they would like to see continue as far as, you know, some of the policies that Obama has enacted. So, you know, there is real advocacy going on right now. And really, it's sort of a wait and see, you know, game. But I think if people out there really want to, you know, do something, you know, I think that they should, you know, call their state senators and their, you know, Congress people, and you know, just contacting their elected officials and really advocate, you know, on behalf of Native people and themselves, because ultimately, you know, water issues or land issues, etc., you know, it affects all of us.
Alicia Goodsoldier will be speaking about understanding historical trauma, how American Indian communities are changing the legacy. The event is part of the monthly Interface series, and it's happening Friday morning in Boulder at the Naropa North Boulder campus. It's on 30th Street in North Boulder. Check in at 7:15, and the programme goes from 7:30 to 9:45 a.m. And Alicia Goodsoldier is the co-chair of the Denver American Indian Commission, but she has, as we have been hearing, wearing many hats. Alicia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Maeve.